Yeah, about 70 degrees. In your language.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to play a song and do my intro, and then I'll bring you on as my guest.
Okay, I look forward to it, my friend.
All righty, Mike.
May the blessing of light be upon you, light on the outside, light on the inside. With God's sunlight shining on you, may your heart glow with warmth, like a turf fire that welcomes friends and strangers alike. May the light of the Lord shine from your eyes like a candle in the window, welcoming the weary traveler. May the blessing of God's soft rain be on you, falling gently on your head, refreshing your soul with the sweetness of little flowers newly blooming. May the strength of the winds of heaven bless you, carrying the rain to wash your spirit clean, sparkling after in the sunlight. May the blessing of God's earth be on you, and as you walk the roads, may you always have a kind word for those you meet. May you understand the strength and power of God in a thunderstorm in winter, and the quiet beauty of creation in the calm of a summer sunset. And may you come to realize that, insignificant as you may seem in this great universe, you are an important part of God's plan. May he watch over you and keep you safe from harm.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to By Yahweh's Design. I'm Pastor Dan, your host for this live radio broadcast. Today is the third day of April, year 2016, and we've entitled today's program, Meet Mike Walsh. And as you can tell from the title, that's our guest today. Before we begin, we do dedicate this program to our Heavenly Father, Yahweh, who is the great I Am. We also dedicate this program to his holy remnant, who are the believing sons and daughters of Jacob, who was later named Israel. And today these people are known as the Caucasian, or the true Israelite peoples of the world. Hallelujah, which means all praise Yahweh in ancient or paleo Hebrew. To my Welsh kinsmen across the ocean, Shumai, welcome to the program. If you wish to go to our website, There's a lot of information there and a way to donate if you wish to help us out financially, and it's by yahwehsdesign.com. If you wish to send a comment or constructive criticism, the email address is bydpastordan@yahoo.com. All right. One little quote I want to give here before we bring Mike on. This is Thomas Jefferson. When injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. All right, now I want to introduce everybody to our guest, Mike Walsh, Irishman living in Spain at the moment. Is that not true?
That is absolutely right. I'm European, I suppose, pan-European first and foremost, but Irish and English background and living in Spain, and my heart is in Latvia. This is a beautiful little country. It should really be the sister nation to Ireland. Both are very ancient nations and deeply steeped in truth and culture, and here is to be found the heart of Europe.
All right, Mike. Okay, if you don't mind, you're my first time guest on this radio show, and so I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit and ask you to give a bio of yourself so the listening audience, you know, knows a little bit more about you.
Yeah, no problem at all. The name is Mike, or Michael Walsh, and I'm a writer, a journalist, and so far I have my name on over 36 books, and if you add the books that I've ghosted, and we're talking in the region of 60 books. Poetry, I've been writing poetry for 50 years. I'm around about 700 poems now, and 11 collections have been published, which are all available on Amazon. They cover a diversity of topics, Dan, and your wonderful listeners, not just romantic, but religious, spiritual, anti-war, and of course, European values. So I write poetry, I pen poetry, compose poetry for ethnic Europeans, wherever in the world they are. These are my people, and they're selling very, very well. And for those who may be negative about poetry, I can quite understand your sentiments, because poetry, along with art, sculpture, music, so many other forms of cultural evocation, have been hijacked by the common enemy, and they have been degraded. So we didn't leave poetry and art and music. Poetry, art, and music left us. Well, I am giving it back to the people, and they will find this in the poetry of Michael Walsh, and of course the books, the titles of Michael Walsh, which are very, very popular. I enjoy an international reputation. I come from quite a pedigree, actually. My father had fought in three or four conflicts by the time he was 40. He fought in the Irish War of Independence in 1920. As a matter of fact, as a 16-year-old, he had a reward circulated on his head by the British Army for his activity fighting against the deplorable Black and Tans, which were the dregs of England's prisons at the time. And it was a terrible war of attrition by both sides. After that, he emigrated to the United States. He lived in New York for quite some time. He helped to build the New York subway. And he was very, very active there because, of course, there was a great deal of unrest. He was in the Civil Guard, actually, in the United States for quite some time. And then the Spanish Civil War broke out in 1936. And along with people from many other nations, he decided, it was a very difficult period, one has to remember. I can sympathize. Everybody was looking for a relief from capitalism. And at the degradations caused by capitalism were absolutely appalling. In the United States, of course, you have the Great Depression, of which 7 million Americans needlessly died of hunger-related disease and hunger directly. Similar numbers proportionally died in Britain. And it's hardly surprising that people were desperately looking for a solution. Some joined the Communist Party thinking that international socialism would be the answer, and as many more decided that national socialism, the socialism of the Workers' Reich, was the answer. So my father, Patrick, he fought in the Spanish Civil War, in my opinion, although he conceded my opinions, he fought on the wrong side. But there you are, that's life. He was an immensely courageous man. And afterwards, he was a pilot, an engineer pilot in the Royal Air Force during World War II. So he's quite a character. As a matter of fact, he was a very good associate of an American who you'll be very familiar with, Ernest Hemingway. They served on the front lines at Jarama and other great battles in the Spanish Civil War. He was a friend of Sean O'Casey, the famous Irish playwright. My mother was a friend of Dolores Ibarreiro, the socialist leader of Spain during the Spanish Civil War, who was afterwards vanquished. And both my parents were deeply immersed in literature. And of course, this is what this is what happens when Kathleen Walsh, literati, and Patrick McLaughlin, a man of that pedigree background, get together. You know, they produce a Michael Walsh, and there you are. There you have me. And a little bit more about me. I was a sailor. I was a Liverpool sailor. I left home at 15 years old, and by the time I was 22, I think at the last count, I had visited over 60 countries, and I was in the Congo, what used to be the Belgian Congo. During the Congo uprising, all along the West African coast, East African coast. So I was there during the transfer from colonial Africa, when it was carved up by the various European nations until it had achieved independence. Not that it benefited from that, of course, but there you are. I have lived an interesting life, a colourful life, and it's quite a tapestry, I can assure you. And thank you for listening and allowing me to share it with your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, some of the, I ordered three of your books. I know you've written a lot more, but the one that I'm reading right now that I find quite interesting, The Triumph of Reason, The Thinking Man's Guide to Adolf Hitler. Also, The Program of the NSDAP, Blueprint for National Survival. And the other third book is Europe Arise, Europe in Flames, Cause and Solution. Now, if you could, talk to us a little bit about what made you write these books and what the people would find in them if they were to buy them.
Well, first and foremost, I'm a purveyor of truth. You know, so obviously everything has to be labelled in this world, and I get labelled a National Socialist, and I've been labelled quite a few things which are even more derogatory. But the background that I have, I had learned a great deal about the changing politics of this world. I was born into a very, very troubled period, and I started questioning the victor's version of history. And at the time when I was a young man, you have to remember that many of the older seamen that I sailed with had actually fought in the war, and not a few of them had actually been captured and taken prisoners by the Germans. Well, of course, to a 15 or 16 or 18 year old, you know, meeting people with such background was an absolutely fascinating experience. It was a privilege to talk to them. And of course, these had a first-hand knowledge of the period. So That was far better than talking through a newspaper to reporters who wouldn't know a German if they'd fallen over one. And I do recall one conversation with a quartermaster on the Britannic. The Britannic was a Cunard line, the White Star. It was the last of the White Star liners, of which you'll be familiar with the Titanic. All the ships ended up in IC, like Olympic, and Britannic and Georgic and Titanic. He was talking to me one day in the mess room, and he told me that his ship had been sunk by a German submarine. Well, as you can imagine, Dan, I was wide-eyed with awe at such an adventure unfolding, and the guy who experienced it talking with me. And, of course, I interrogated him, for want of a better word. I couldn't understand why he was there, because everything I had been taught, the Germans machine-gunned survivors in the water. You know, I couldn't understand why he was there to tell me the tale. As it all happened, and he told me about, you know, the sudden sinking. The ship had been hit by a torpedo or two. It had developed a list, and it had started sinking, and they took to the lifeboats. I said, okay, what happened then? And he said, well, it was a bit tough, and he said the crew of the U-boat took us on board. He said there was about 15 or 20 of us, I seem to recall, that, you know, they took on board. Well, I don't know how many of you have been on a submarine, especially of that period. You know what a sardine in a tin feels like. It's pretty cramped. And I asked him, you know, what was it like on board? And he answered me just as I have spoken. You know, it was pretty cramped. I said, well, what happened? Anyway, to cut a long story short, he told me that he and his crewmates had been taken to Germany. They spent the rest of the war, as with many others, in the German concentration camps. And their accounts of the period spent in the war camps was far better than Butlins and Pontins, which were the holiday camps in England at the time. They got good entertainment, they were educated, some were educated to university level, and it was, I think most of the British soldiers had realised how comfortable life was in the German concentration camps. They would have probably surrendered and the war would have been over a lot earlier. But he was the very first of those I met, and of course I started making inquiries in that age group, and I learned a great deal, all that was positive. And I can say, and I'm crossing myself as I am saying this, I have yet to meet a British serviceman who actually encountered German troops in one way or another speak negatively about the experience. They all spoke very, very highly of them. Then, when I was talking about this, I was talking with a friend, and he said, well, have you listened to this music? And I started listening to the music of the Third Reich. You know, there were tape cassettes at the time, and 45 revs per minute, discs, that sort of thing. Pretty primitive by today's standards, I can assure you. But I was so romanticized by the beautiful music of the period. And it was not war songs, it was songs that loved their country, their people, their religion, their way of life. It was wonderful. It was a shot in the arm to me. And of course, one thing led to another. And I think I must have been in my 30s when I wrote the first of my books, a small one, well out of print now. And all I wanted to do, Dan, was to set the record straight. That book was called For Those Who Cannot Speak. It was a short book, but it asked the questions and it answered them. All of the vexed questions about did 6 million really die, and was Hitler a dictator, and who was the Waffen-SS, the usual stories that one gets asked in a bar. And I answered them truthfully with the pictures, and it was a bestseller. And then I brought out another book that was called Death of a City. We've all heard of Dresden. We preferred that we had never ever heard, except in positive terms, of that beautiful Florence of the North that was incinerated by the Allies. literally incinerated. Nothing moved, not even a stray cat. It was a city, a beautiful city that was disappeared from the face of the earth. And we think of Dresden, but what we tend to forget, it overshadows the others. And 56 at my count, we're talking about the major cities now, Dan. We're not talking about the villages and the towns. 56 German, Central European, wonderful, beautiful cities were completely erased from the face of the earth for no other reason than they were populated by ethnic Germans. That, my friend, is genocide. And so I started writing, and when the pen started flying, I was using my heart as my inkwell, and the book started to appear. And as I say, there are 36 of them now. You have chosen wisely, by the way. You've chosen a very good diversity of the books that I've published, and it's good to talk about them, and they have a great relevancy to today. And these are just part of the Mike or Michael Walsh library. Now, let me explain the difference between Michael Walsh and Mike Walsh. There was a necessity, I won't go into the reasons for it, there was a necessity to separate the two. So if you're looking for poetry by myself, non-political, it's Michael Walsh. W-A-L-S-H. It's all on Amazon. Just go onto Amazon and look for Michael Walsh, heart-to-heart poetry. If you're looking for the political, the books on the right, on the Reich, on various other related topics, then look for Mike Walsh, Witness to History. If you go to Mike Walsh, Witness to History, then of course you will see readers also bought this sort of thing. It will lead you to the other titles. So Michael Walsh, heart-to-heart poetry, and Mike Walsh is the Reich. For those people who are interested in the Reich, who isn't? It's an interesting thing, Dan, that of the books that I've mentioned, 10 or 11 of them are on the Reich. 10 or 11 of them are on poetry, 10 or 11 of them are on diverse subjects, but 95% of the books are sold are related to the Third Reich, or as I call it, the Workers' Reich. There you are. There's a little bit about my background in writing.
Yeah, that is amazing. You were mentioning Dresden. I've read quite a few accounts, and the one reason that they destroyed Dresden, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but was not Dresden the center of Christian culture at that time and had been for hundreds of years? Dresden, Germany, was one of the major centers of the Christian faith. There were many, many churches and historic buildings and architecture, different things like that of the Christian faith that were in Dresden. And it would make sense that the Jews, Eisenhower and Marshall and the rest of them, would turn the Allied bombers on Dresden to firebomb it, since the Jews hate Christians.
Yeah, you are absolutely right, and not many people are astute enough to pick up on this, because most of the time people say, well, okay, Dresden was not involved in the war, there was no anti-aircraft, they weren't making anything that contributed to the German war effort. There was no military reason for its eradication, but you've just hit the nail on the head. There was a very good reason from the Allies' point of view, that it was deeply, deeply religious. It was deeply Christian. And on this point, one will notice Japan is a vast country, a very big country of scores of cities. Why was Nagasaki in Hiroshima chosen to be eradicated, vaporized by the atomic bomb? And they were the only two Catholic cities in Japan. That was the reason why they were chosen, to be completely annihilated. And the targets for the bombs were the Catholic centers of these great Japanese cities. So it was not just a war against Japan, it was not just a war against Germany, it was against the it was a war against the Christian ethics of Europe.
Yeah, I would agree.
It was a war against Jesus Christ, Dan. It was a war against Jesus Christ. If people want to say that it was against Japan or against Germany or against Italy, they're free to do so, but it was a war against Christianity, and we know who, and we know why, and we know when.
Absolutely. Now, I was on the previous program I was co-hosting. We were talking about this interview coming up, and I mentioned to him in the one book on the program of the NSDAP how much the Third Reich's program for restoring Germany, it fits with biblical principles. Line by line, as I was reading in your book, the things that they would do to restore Germany were actual biblical concepts, non-interest loans and return the land to the farmers and keep aliens out of your government. These are all biblical principles.
I think you're talking of the program of the NSDAP here. Now, this is one of the most, this is perhaps, in my view, the most important book of the 20th century and perhaps of several centuries. People talk about Das Kapital or Mein Kampf, or, the various other titles that we're familiar with as being great motivators of social change. But the little-known program of the NSDAP by Gottfried Feder, a German National Socialist, was the book that truly not only changed history, but it could change the future too. Now, if you're a boat enthusiast or if you're a car enthusiast, the first thing that you do before you go and buy your parts is you go and get a manual to learn how to put it all together. If you want to build a nation, then you go out and you get a book called The Program of the NSDAP, because as you've quite rightly pointed out, if anybody was to apply this fix-it manual to any modern country, let's talk about Libya or Syria, or Russia, or Belarus, or the United States for that matter, all of the answers are in that book. It doesn't belong to the 1930s, it certainly doesn't belong to the 1940s, it belongs to mankind, European mankind that wants to rebuild their countries. And it's a very interesting thing. People say, well, National Socialism died in 1945, May the 8th. Where is its relevancy today, 70 years on? I'll tell you where its relevancy today is that program of the NSDAP is being cherry-picked across the world to put nations back in power, the people back in power. And we're finding this that as I look through the constitution and the social changes through countries like Russia and Belarus, China, diverse, sometimes opposite to American policy, you will find that many of the ingredients that they have used to bring their states up into a progressive, even a futuristic mode, many of the principles applied have been lifted straight out of Gottfried Feder's program of the NSDAP, and it was not Hitler. Hitler takes the credit, absolutely. He was the leader, but he was the leader that got this manual, and he was the leader who brought this, who used the principles of the manual, of the program of the NSDAP, to create the Germany. Now, in January 1933, Germany was like Ukraine today. It was on its knees. It was hopelessly in debt. There were 6 million unemployed. It was probably one of, certainly and absolutely, it was the poorest, most wretched country in Europe. Within months, not talking of years, we're talking 36, 42 months, it became second only to the United States in terms of wealth. Obviously, it's a small country, it's smaller than the state of Texas. But I will tell you this, is that there's very, very few people in the United States have experienced quality of life as good as they did in Germany between 1933 and 1945. Very, very few people.
You know, I was out in Iowa working some years ago with a friend of mine, and we happened to run into a German woman, an older woman, at a local tavern. And my friend and I approached her and said, "Would you mind talking to us a little bit?" And she was very suspicious. And she said, "Why? What do you want to talk to me?" And we said, "Well, because you lived in Germany under Hitler. You were there. You were a young girl, but still, you actually saw it." And my friend and I, his name was Larry, I said, we know we've been lied to. I said, we'd just like to hear what you have to say. And the woman, again, looked all around the room very suspiciously.
Yes, I can understand.
And she said, "You in America don't have any idea what it was like in Germany. That I can tell you. You Americans don't have any idea." And she went on to say that it was a beautiful land, beautiful country, peace and prosperity. And we called Adolf Hitler grandfather. That was the nickname, grandfather, because he was a man of the people. And she goes, it was a wonderful time. But she said, and I asked her, I said, "Why are you looking around the room all the time?" I said, we're in a small town in Iowa, and my friend and I are curious, and we're not associated with anybody." And she said, "You always have to be careful. Even today, I have to be careful who I talk to." Can you imagine that?
I can imagine it. I can experience it. We suffer from it in Europe probably much more than you do in the United States. And a good friend of mine, Gerhard Lauck, we used to take what was freely available in the United States, material relating to National Socialism, and we used to smuggle it into Germany at the time. And I remember one day we were taking the ferry from England, Hull, to Denmark, Esbjerg. And we were going to meet some German friends on the border, the Danish and the German border. And Gerhard from Illinois, I thought he was being totally paranoid. When we were on the ferry, it was a modern, beautiful ferry, and of course we're talking the 1970s now, a wonderful experience. And he says, "Don't make it too obvious," he says, "but the blonde and the guy with her," he said, "well, they're shadowing us." He says, "They're probably secret police." And I looked at him and I thought, no, he hasn't had a drink. And, you know, maybe he's being a bit paranoid, a little bit, you know, over suspicious, you know. I didn't take too much notice, but again, he drew my attention to it a little bit later on. So, being curious, I took a closer look at this couple, and yes, wherever we went on the ferry, yeah, they just happened to coincidentally be there. So we got off the ferry in Esbjerg in Denmark, and we caught a train, and guess who was on the train? The same couple. It was winter, I can tell you, it was pretty cold. And everywhere we went, they were following us, and he said, "Watch this." And we were in some small town in Denmark. It was getting on in the evening. And he said, "We're going to jump off at the next station." And he said, "And we'll catch the next train back." And guess what? We jumped off the train, and the couple jumped off with us. So it was pretty obvious then we were being followed. And this is the story of my life. When we booked into a hotel on the border to await the visit by our German friends across the border, the entire hotel was surrounded by police, plain clothes, and the dogs. We went off to talk in the forests where we could talk without any microphones being the thing. This put the police off the scent. We got our conversations and our plans done and completed. And just at that time, the police had caught up with us, and we could hear the howling of the dogs through the forests of Denmark, and we made our getaway. But that's the way it was. And long before the internet, we tend to think that there's a certain security in what we do, Dan, and there isn't. You know, I led the British movement in England for many years, the British National Socialist Movement, and I attended many, many rallies and meetings, demonstrations, marches in London and other cities too. And I always recall going down there. Now, London is a big city. We're talking 13, 14 million people. It's a vast city, you know, it's much bigger than some countries. And as we approached off the motorway and we were going into London, we noticed that we were being shadowed. Now, the police knew exactly where we were. They knew when we were going. They just followed us all the way. They meant no harm. They just wanted to know what we were up to. And another time, I know you've not familiar with the geography of England and Wales, but I had a meeting organised for a city in Leeds in Yorkshire, and being poverty stricken, because we revolutionaries are always poverty stricken, we're not paid by the Jews or anybody else like that, I did call my friend in Leeds and I said, David, I said, I'm not so sure I should be making this trip. You know, I got two tyres on the front of my car which really need attention. I said, if I get stopped, David, I said, you know, I'm going to get a ticket for each of those tyres. Oh, I said, take the chance, Mike, take the chance. He said, you know, they're not that bad, surely. And he said, well, he said, take a chance, come on. He says, we want to hear you speak. So, biting my bottom lip, a couple of hours later, I packed my overnight bag and I got in my car and off I went. I only got 1 mile down the road and there was a police block there. They let all of the other cars through. I was the only one that was pulled in. They didn't look at my documents or anything of that nature. They just went round, had a look at my front tyres. I got two tickets and they told me not to move the car. That was the end of my meeting that night. They're pretty sophisticated, believe me. But rather than alarm your listeners, they're harmless. They just want to know what's going on. The state is in a state of paranoia. They want to know what you guys are doing. They don't necessarily mean you any harm. I always say, as you will read in Europa Rise, which you have kindly bought, stay on the right side of the law. National Socialist Germany, it was a revolution in thought, and they took power without breaking the law. And as Adolf Hitler said, that the more people lost their lives in the tiny abortive Easter uprising in Dublin than died in the full revolution of the National Socialist Movement. So they did it peacefully. We can do it peacefully. We can fight them at their own game.
Yep, we will. We
sorry, Dan, I do tend to ramble on, you know, but you ask me how you talk. I'm Irish. Forgive me.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'm part Irish myself. The I was curious, though, why you've chosen to live in Spain, if you don't mind talking about that a little bit.
Well, for absolutely the same reasons as somebody in Northern America decides to come down and live in Florida when they retire, because the weather is better. In many respects, Western Europe is one state. There are no border controls or anything like that. We can fly from here to any of the northern countries, very reasonably priced and with a minimum of formality, and we do so. So, Western Europe here, Spain, Liverpool I was brought up in, I was a contemporary of the Beatles, that period. And right now, I should imagine that in Liverpool, it's a pretty cold, nasty, grey, wet day. Here, the weather is very, very similar to what you're experiencing in Florida. So that's my reason for being here. The healthcare, by the way, is absolutely extravagant. The healthcare, and you do need it when you're getting on in years, more so than the younger generation, is I would say, honestly, that the healthcare that I receive here, and it's all free of charge because we paid for it, and the national health contributions throughout our working lives in England, is probably on a par to what the King and Queen of England would get. It's the royal family, anyway. It's absolutely superb. It just simply couldn't be better. And we're called coffin dodgers here because there are so many of us here who would almost certainly be dead now, mortally dead, because of the inadequacies of the so-called National Health Service in England. But here in Spain, apparently it's the best in the world, and I wouldn't argue with that. So we're here for three reasons. The weather is absolutely blissful. The cost of living is much lower than it is in England. And the health service, at least for Britons and Germans, is you simply can't beat it. It would be the same for an American living here, but he would have to pay for it, of course.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. And now, how do you did you learn Spanish, or are there a lot of English-speaking people there?
Yeah, it's not necessary. I suppose it's the other way around. You guys are always talking about the Mexican incursions into the United States, and they're a part of the United States where English is little spoken. It's all Spanish, and here it's the other way around. You know, I think the non-Spanish community of where I live, Torrevieja, which is quite a big city, it's 400,000, and the population is... there's not much in it, it's only marginal, but the population is 49% Spanish and 51% other nations. So English is very well, widely spoken in Europe. I believe that on average, 40% of Europeans can converse some way in English. It's better in some places than others. As it so happens, the Spanish are the hopeless at learning other languages. They're almost as bad as Americans. And there is a joke about the English that we don't learn to. You know, they say, what do you call a person who knows several languages? Oh, it says a multilingualist. Okay, what do you call a person who speaks two languages? He's bilingual. And what do you call a person who speaks one language? English.
Yeah. Yep.
It's very true. We do try, Dan, we do try, but when we go into a bank or a shop or a department store or something like that, we do try to speak in their own language. Invariably, they say, it's okay, I speak English, so we don't have to.
That's amazing. Now, you're on the peninsula that used to be called Iberia. Iberia meaning land of the Hebrews, which is our people. And interestingly enough, Ireland used to be called Ibernia, correct?
That's right.
And Ibernia is the new land of the Hebrews, because the Irish originally were in Europe and they migrated up there. And it went from being Iberia to Ibernia, because that was where they ended up. And then, of course, a portion of Ireland, the Irish anyway, went up and formed into Scotland and became the Scots. But they're actually displaced Irishmen, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's
The Celtic influence, the dark, because you've got an absolutely clear definition of ethnic background. We're both the same, we're brother and sister of the same race, Aryan race. But it's the same in England as it is in Ireland. As you go down the east coast of England and Ireland, the colour of the skin is very pale and predominantly blonde. And as you go down the west coasts of these countries, England and Ireland, then it's predominantly dark. So Rudolf Hess on the left, and I don't know, Himmler on the right, if you like, or Heydrich on the right. So two distinct peoples, but of the same race. But you're absolutely right about the origins of Iberia and Hibernia.
It's one of the interesting things is I studied what we call the identity message, where when you study that and the migrations of the Israelites and they became the various tribes, it's a wonderful story. Like you said, we don't get told the truth in school or in government and different things like that. They feed us what they want us to believe versus the truth. So now you mentioned you have a book, Witness to History. I did not see that one. I probably would have bought that one too. But what could you tell us a little bit about that book and what's in it?
Yeah, it's an interesting book. It took 25 years, you know, to complete it. And again, because the first book that I'd ever written, For Those Who Cannot Speak, it was the title, of course, was related to the fact that we were not allowed to speak about Germany anymore, about the Third Reich, not truthfully anyway. And Witness to History started, and talking with people and buying books, which many of which are no longer available. We live in a period of terrible censorship now. I kept on drawing experiences and adding them down and adding them down. And in the end, I ended up with a book which was 120,000 words long. Now, Dan, if I write a book, or if you write a book, or anybody else writes a book, it's an opinion. It's your opinion, or it's my opinion. So, you know, you're entitled to your opinion, I'm entitled to mine. What I wanted to do, Dan, with Witness to History, was not install my opinion at all. This was everything that happened from the Bolshevik overthrow of the legitimate government of the Tsars in Russia in 1917, how that led to the revolution and civil war in Germany in 1918-1920, and how it fueled the National Socialist resistance to Germany becoming another Bolshevized Russia, and how those who had financed, Wall Street bankers, who had financed this great plantation from the Atlantic to the Bering Strait at Alaska, to, you know, just to be a plantation of white Christians, the only one who stood in the way of that Jewish dream was the Adolf Hitler and the National Socialist Party. And they came very, very close to destroying, well, they used, of course, Bolshevik-occupied Russia. I don't call it communist Russia. I don't call it the Soviet Union. I don't call it the USSR anymore. I call it Bolshevik-occupied Russia, because the Russians were as much victims, well, far more victims than any of us were. And the Ukrainians were, of course. You know, people say the 7 million people died in Ukraine. Ukraine is a large country. It's the largest country in Europe. It's bigger than Spain. 7 million, they say, died during the imposed famine. It was not a famine. You think of a famine, you think of a natural disaster, like a volcano or an earthquake or something like that. It was a deliberate policy of starvation as a means of population control, just as the British had imposed on Ireland in the 18th century, and in Bengal in the 20th century, in which tens of millions of Indians had died. And it was population control. Bolshevism cannot feed 44 million people, so 10 million of them had to go. And it was Joseph Stalin himself who said, yes, 10 million died there, and many, many millions more died in Russia. And the population of Russia today is, I seem to recall, 144 million. Now, it's a country which is vastly bigger than the United States, but its population is only one third of the size of the population of the United States. The population of Russia, had it not been for Bolshevism, would now stand very, very similar figures to those of the United States. The population of Russia should be 350 million, but conservative estimates put the number of people dead, directly due or indirectly due to Bolshevism, is placed at 70 to 100 million people. Now, all of those people, Dan, would have gone on to produce families, Christian families. Of course, the dead don't produce, they don't reproduce in a mortal sense. So that's a terrific loss to the white cultural world. I remember in Ben Classen's book, I think he said at the turn of the 20th century, the white population was, I think, about 30%. It was a large number of people on the earth. Today it is reckoned at 8%, and we're standing down at 5 minutes to midnight, and this is the final war, the refugee influx into Europe, to finally destroy ethnic Europeans. And then you will all, wherever you are in the world, you'll be in reservations, just as the Indians, the Incas, and the Aztecs are. You'll be confined to your own place, and you will no longer be in control of your own lives. And, this is the importance. And just touching back briefly, Witness to History was a statement of the truth. What I wanted to do was record a chronicle of all of these terrible things from 1917 until 1945, not in my words, which in an opinion are worth nothing, but in the words of the people who did it. So we have the confessions of the Jews who financed Bolshevism. We have the confessions of the Jews and their Christian allies who destroyed Russia. We have all of the expressions of all of the great National Socialists of why they were fighting, what they were fighting for, and giving us a record of their struggle against international communism. And during the war, Winston Churchill is heavily quoted, Eisenhower, Truman, Roosevelt, of course. And it takes you, it is a chronicle, there are four volumes, because the book was so big and because it's heavily illustrated, I decided that it would be beyond most people's budgets if I was to publish it in one form, in one book, and it has been published in one book, and I can't understand it, why it's so expensive. It's about $57, and for some reason, when we Europe publish a book on Amazon, it's much more expensive than if we published it in the United States. I don't know why, because Americans, thank the Lord, are the biggest buyers of our books. But for some reason, it's $57, so I had previously decided to do Witness to History in four volumes. So there's a one, a two, a three, and a four. And these are affordable. I think they're about $12, $17 each. And because they're affordable, because people can buy one and they like one, they can go on to number two, it will take them. Now, if they take those books down from volume one to volume four, then they will know how much they have been lied to, just as you were with your friend in Iowa. They will find what was really like in Germany and what the war was all about. We have a word in Europe, we call it gobsmacked. You know, they will just keep on putting the pages down and just say, I can't believe I'm reading it, but they can't deny it. It's not my opinion. This is the truth being read out by the people who poisoned that century.
It's it makes me think that one of the reasons all the electronic devices that have been produced and are made so cheap. Mass production, of course, is part of that, but it's also the fact that the Jew wants us to have all these devices in our home because they're tools to propagandize us and diversions to keep us away from doing any kind of serious study and reading. Or how do you see that? I mean, that's the way I see it. I used to marvel at some of these sophisticated devices and how cheap they were. And it was like, how do they make them so cheap? And now it makes perfect sense. You make them cheap because you want them in everybody's home. You want a television in every room of the house. You want a computer now and iPads and iPods for music. And you want the beast system to have access to your family members 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, it's like a lot of other things in our lives, like telephones and the ability to write. You know, it could be used for bad purpose, it could be used for good purpose. It's the same as a camera. It can be used to destroy the human mind. It can be used to provide uplifting inspiration. And the internet is a very, very powerful tool, and it's frightening the life out of them. You are absolutely right in saying they have provided a distraction, and people are preoccupied with celebrities and the sort of thing that is really of no consequence. But a lot of these people, and this is a positive side of things, and I don't wish any insult or to cause offence to anybody, but the kind of people who are totally immersed in the soap operas of television and the titter-tattle and the celebrities, they don't really matter. They are sheeple. These are cattle. Nothing can be done with them. They will come out and they will bark their approval of anybody with a crown who comes down the road. Napoleon referred to them when he was going through Paris and his carriage was surrounded by tens of thousands of applauding people. The ever realistic Napoleon turned round and said, yes, as many will come out to see me guillotined as well. This was a very pragmatic approach. The internet, believe me, Dan, is frightening the life out of the new world order, because we have taken back control of the information, and this is causing them great alarm. At the time of the 1930s, you had to believe the media simply because you didn't have a choice, you didn't have an alternative. Who else were you to believe? So whatever you were watching, CBS or Fox News or whatever the equivalents were at the time, you had no choice but to believe them. Those days are gone. If your readers say, okay, this is what Fox News says, I'm going to hear what Moscow has to say, so they go over to Sputnik International, or they go on to Russia Today. They're going to get two sides of the story. I honestly believe, Dan, that had this system been in place in the 1930s, we would not have had a Second World War, and you would not have lost 700,000 or whatever it was, American young men. The internet is a very, very powerful tool. It's undermining them, and it is frightening Washington, it is frightening Berlin, and it is frightening the square mile in London. Excuse me.
Now, when you were talking about the immigration, and it's actually a form of genocide, wouldn't that make the leaders of the various European nations that are allowing this to go on and actually encouraging it, are they not criminals guilty of genocide?
Absolutely, and they should be put on trial for being such. I think what most people don't understand in their innocence, perhaps I do because of my political sophistication, my experience, which goes back a long time, longer than I care to remember, is most politicians, including your own, have been compromised. They're being compromised in one or two ways, but it is usually sexual or it's fiscal. They've either been caught with their fingers in the till, or they're being caught in the bed with the wrong person. Now, once you compromise a person, you totally control them. Now, the psychological nature of people who are attracted to, we're talking mainstream politics, we're not talking about revolutionary politics, we are idealists. We tend not to, be compromised. It doesn't occur to us. But the kind of politician who goes into politics, he wants power, he wants money, he is totally corrupt, he is morally corrupt, he hasn't got any ethics at all except self-aggrandizement. And he's an arrogant man or an arrogant woman. And believe me, they tend to be very, very stupid too. So once they get involved in the trappings of power and they've got a lot of money going into their bank accounts, which they do, and they have access to the best restaurants and the best hotels, and they put themselves above the sheeple, they are very, very easily corrupted, and it's quite easy to convince them that were you, the law applies to you and me, it no longer applies to them. Now, human beings are weak by nature. And if they are seduced into a compromising situation, a sexual situation or financial situation, as soon as the evidence is accumulated, and it doesn't take long, one picture taken in a hotel bedroom is all enough. Then these politicians are totally controlled, and they will do whatever the people behind the scenes want them to do. And there is the picture of Europe and the United States today. I've always said that if there was a revolution in any European country now, one of the first things that I would do, whether it was small states like Latvia or Estonia, large states like Germany or France or Spain or Italy or England, I would go straight into the bank accounts of the political elite, and you would be horrified at what you would find, at how much they have been compromised. So it's not a moral judgment when they allow refugees into England and do other things which defy common sense. They know who's paying their wages, and they know that that's, if they don't, if they rebel, as Viktor Orban does, presumably he's not one of those corrupted. He's the Prime Minister of Hungary, and he is being a real pain in the neck to them in resisting the refugee invasion, so-called refugees. They're not refugees, of course. These are a pain, but he can't be controlled. They don't have any situations in which Viktor Orban is controlled. They don't have any situations where Vladimir Putin is controlled. These people have led blameless lives for the large part. They might pick their nose now and again, but that's hardly front page news. But the others have all been compromised. I would say that most German politicians, French politicians, anything, if they step out of line, Dan, then they will be on the headlines the next day. I have seen this happen time after time. Gordon Brown, he was a very, very capable, I don't like the guy because he was a Labour Party politician, but he was a very, very capable political leader in the 1960s. He was Deputy Prime Minister, so if anything had happened to the Prime Minister at the time, which was Wilson, Harold Wilson, then Gordon Brown would have been the Prime Minister of England. That's how powerful he was. He was a foreign minister also. He made one mistake. Oh, he was the darling of the press, but he made one mistake. During a visit to occupied Palestine, he criticised the Israeli hostilities committed against the innocent Palestinian people. He opened his mouth and he criticised Israel, and that was the end of his political career. From that day on, you never picked up a newspaper to find him a little bit inebriated. Now, all politicians like a drink. All politicians like to do stupid things, get into bed with the wrong people. They never go on the front pages of the newspaper, but poor old Gordon Brown did, and they assassinated his character, and he was gone in no time at all. And I've seen this happen, and it happens in the United States one time after another. Like Patton, General Patton, they assassinated these characters. That's what they're good at. They're murderers. The press are murderers.
Well, they're press is murderers, but they're literal murderers as well. I was going to ask, on your book, Witness to History, you say it's in four volumes. How did you decide what would be in each volume? A certain years or what?
How it all progressed. I talked before, Dan, about the so-called Russian Revolution. It wasn't a revolution, it was a seizure of power. Same as you had in Libya today or Syria today. They ousted the legitimate government, and they, on that occasion, they succeeded. They ousted the democratic government of Russia, and of course they murdered the very Christian royal family, the Tsar family, and they replaced it with mostly Jewish Bolsheviks. And the first book is devoted to the resurrection of Germany. I forget what the name, I think the name of the book is Resurrection Volume 1. And then Volume 2 is the prelude to war, and this is how Britain, financed by America, unfortunately, positioned themselves to destroy the new German Workers' Reich. which presented not only a threat to Bolshevism, but it also represented a threat to the imperial trade preferences of the British Empire at the time. Remember, we had one. And then page three is the progress of the war. Volume three is progress of the war. And then the last volume is catastrophe. And this is the destruction of this great German nation of Christians, 80 million German Christians, and it was the attempt to totally destroy them. So the four volumes of Witness to History are the salvation of ruined Germany after the First World War, then the prelude to war, then of course the terrible crimes that were committed against Germany during the process of the Second World War, the bombing of German cities, the decimation of their population, and catastrophe, you know, when Germany was reduced very much in size and its population. I worked it out that probably 15 million Germans, obviously mostly civilian, 15 million Germans lost their lives after the war had ended. Far more Germans died after the war than died before, during the war. And this was the attempt to destroy the pivotal Christian nation of our Europe. And it's your Europe too. You may live in America, but as I've said to others, the day will come when your forebears left Europe under duress, as perhaps economic migrants, or you were driven out for Christian religious reasons. You went to the United States, and I can honestly see the day when you'll be welcomed back to Europe, to come back to your homelands.
Yeah, I can see that. Actually, I'm on one side of the family Welsh-Irish, on the other side of the family German. And many people in the United States have Germanic blood in them. Many of the patriotic meetings and identity meetings that I've gone to, we used to get up and we were talking to the groups, and at one point we would say, how many people in here have Germanic blood in them? And we usually got 90 to 95% response.
Yep.
So, in fact, the United States was only one vote away from speaking German as the official language. If one man had voted the other way, German would have been the language for the United States, not English. So, interesting. Now, is Amazon the only place to get your books, Mike?
Yeah, they're the ones they hold the control over that. But it's a good thing. You were talking about technology. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? And it's both. It depends. It's like the knife in your hand. You can either kill somebody or you can make your life better with the knife in your hand. But Amazon is good. Okay, it's a little bit on the expensive side because there's a lot of marketing to go into it. And, you know, I suppose it's an amazing thing. You know, for a person of my age, Dan, when I first published, for those who cannot speak, I finished it off and it went off to the publishers, Historical Review Press, down in Brighton and Sussex. And then a couple of months later, I telephoned and said, how are things going? And he said, well, it's still at the typesetters. And it went through about half a dozen processes, Dan. And I think I first held that book in my hand about 12 months after I had actually sent it. Now, I'm very prolific as a writer, and once I've got an idea in my mind, and I've got a very good picture researcher here who helps me, this will set you back. You've got to sit down to listen to this. But there was a book recently that I wrote, The Last Gladiators. It's about the mercenaries, the European mercenaries, who were the midwives of nationalist Africa, you know, during the 1960s. So I wanted to divert it. I wanted to break because I was in Africa at the time. Dan, I tell you not a word of a lie. On a Saturday morning, I sat down to write that book. 9 days later, it was published, a beautifully published book on Amazon. Most people think that it's an achievement to write a book once in their life. I wrote that book in 9 days.
Wow.
Okay.
What was the title again, Mike?
The Last Gladiators.
Oh, The Last Gladiators?
The Last Gladiators, Michael Wallace, The Last Gladiators. It's about the American and the British and the Irish, many of the Irish and the Belgian and the German. Many of them had fought in the war against each other. And they had fought on one side or another during the African wars of independence in Rhodesia, in South Africa, the Congo, Biafra in Nigeria, the breakaway Republic of Biafra. And these were, whatever your politics are, you know, these are men. You know, we don't seem to have men like that anymore. I find it difficult. You know, you're an exception, Dan. You're an interesting person to talk with. But my generation, you know, you can like them or you can loathe them. But they were men. And I used to go into New York in 1959 on the Britannic, and those ships were fantastic ships, and the men who sailed on them. I can only say that the men today just don't, they just don't come up to their equals at all. But that's what The Last Gladiators was about. But getting back to the publishing side of things, it's an amazing thing that once I say, right, the book is ready, it's all ready, and I've done everything on my laptop here, I go on to the Amazon Create Space. Okay, it's been a bit of a learning curve because I'm not particularly good at these sort of things. And it is quite a complex process, actually, to publish a book. But once you know it, and we do it. And you remember what I was saying about Tony Hancock and the Historical Review Press, how I sent him a book down to you, a very small book, and it was 12 months before I held it in my hand. If I was to publish a book tonight, after we finish talking, when I wake up in the morning, I go onto my email and I'll get a message from Create Space, congratulations. All I've got to do is approve. All I've got to do is look at the finished book and approve it. And it's there for you in Australia, in the United States, in Latin America, Antarctica. It doesn't matter. You can buy it. And 2 or 3 days, it'll be in your hands. And isn't that fantastic progress?
Yeah, that certainly is. You brought up an interesting point there about men have stopped being men. My personal take on that is a lot of these foods, vaccines, and various other poisons that they're putting into our system, the fluoride in the water, etc., seem to have that effect. I had a good friend was a Russian, had come over here to America, and he lived up in California, and he was telling me he had a professor came from South Africa to visit, and when he got off the plane, one of the first things he said was, "Where are all the men?"
Mm-hmm.
He said, All I see is effeminized boys, and the older guys are somewhat effeminized. Where are the real men? What happened to the men in America?
What happened to them? Indeed, that's a very good word. They have been feminized, and I've lived in a manly environment all of my life. Okay, I went to sea when I was 15, and these were real men. They were hard men. And they were wonderful men. They were my fathers at sea, if you like. You know, so if we stepped out of line, we got a slap over the ear, you know, but it was a real man's life. And those characters are absolutely fantastic. And, of course, I saw the world, and I was nothing unique at the time. We had 300,000 British seamen. And, of course, they all experienced life very much as I did. So there was a lot of us about, and in other trades, you had a British Empire then. And, you know, you used to get 19-year-olds who used to go off to South Africa, and the next thing, they would be controlling a big region now, probably bigger than a prime minister does today. But, you know, there were great characters that I remember on the Britannic ones. Now, we're talking about a ship the size of the Lusitania, a big Cunard ocean liner that sailed from Liverpool, then to Cork in Southern Ireland, that you're familiar with, and then on to New York, Ambrose Lighthouse, very familiar to me. And I recall it was a beautiful summer's morning. It was dawn broke early. It was probably about 4 o'clock, 4:15 in the morning. There was not a soul to be seen, although there would probably be 2,000 or 3,000 people on the ship. They were all fast asleep. And I was on the wheel of the ship. 27,000 tons. It's doing 17 knots, which is the speed of a slow-moving car. And when you've got 27,000 tons, when you turn the steering wheel, it's 6 miles before the ship starts to turn. So when you drive in your car down your high street, you turn the wheel, then you go down the side street that you want to go down. When you turn the wheel on an ocean liner, which is doing about 24 miles an hour, it's going to be 6 miles before the ship responds. He gave me the instructions. I was on the wheel. He gave me the instructions for the compass, and I just, as a 16-year-old do, I just did what I did. Steer 320, steer 325, a little to the and I steered. Do you know what he did, Dan? He took that massive liner right into the coast so I could actually see people coming out of their cottages as the ship swept past them. I cannot imagine what went on in their minds when they came out of their doors in the morning, looked up and saw this huge, planet-sized ocean liner, almost as if it was on a high street outside, careering through. And I think that the chief officer of that particular ship had wanted to do this all of his life, and this was the one golden opportunity when daylight would strike at the break of dawn when everybody was asleep and he could get away with it. And he got away with it. He took that ship between a small rocky island and the mainland of Ireland. I think there was about 0.5 kilometre on either side. It was not much bigger than the Panama Canal. And he sailed it through there at a breakneck speed. And the smug grin on his face, where are the men like that anymore? Now, I know that a lot of readers, and I sympathise with them, they're not going to like what I'm going to say. But I'm just saying, these are men, good and bad. We were sailing mid-Atlantic, and the sea was like a mill pond. It was smooth. And in the distance, probably 6 or 7 miles in the distance, we could see a pod of whales making their way down south, the season being what it was. And he gave me the steering instructions again. And do you know what he was doing, Dan? He was steering the ship for one particular whale, which he had taken a dislike to. And he flung that great ocean liner right into the whale. He ran out onto the wings of the bridge to see the damage that he'd done, and the whale was sliced in half, and all the blood was pouring past the side of the ship. It made his day. I've never forgotten that.
Wow.
Never forgotten. And there was another time, Dan, if I may take your time up a little moment, because this does relate to the United States, and I'm sorry to say, but maybe I'm not sorry to say, I nearly sank once an American warship. I was on a ship called the Columbia Star. It was a starliner, and we'd been right up the west coast of the United States, up San Francisco, Los Angeles, right up to Nanaimo and Westminster, up in Canada to the lumber camps and all the rest of it. We're sailing past that part where the United States waters goes into Mexican waters, so I think the American warship on beautiful, placid Pacific Ocean was patrolling the waters off the Mexican Californian coast. Now, the ship, again, is asleep. You don't have a very big crew on a British merchant ship. It's probably the fast asleep in the afternoon. Certainly the officer of the watch was asleep in the chart room. This poor little 16-year-old is up on the Monkey Island on the ship all on his own. And when a 16-year-old is told to steer a course, he steers a course. You know, it's a bit like that picture of the Roman soldier, faithful unto last. You just do what you're told, and you haven't got the brains to, take any initiative of your own. And ahead of me, Dan, was a beautiful American warship. And he was just sitting there in the water, right in my sights. There was no question about it, Dan. If he stayed where I was, and me being a dutiful 16-year-old, stayed on the course that I had been given, he was going to be sliced in half, and it was going to do a lot of damage to our ship as well. But, you know, when you've got a 16-year-old, you don't have a brain. So I was whispering down the hose pipe as I'm whispering down the microphone to you now, and I said, Officer, what will I do? What will I do? And there was no answer because he was fast asleep. And I just kept on the course that I had been given, and the American warship was coming closer and closer and closer, and I think he was probably no more than a mile away from me, which is very, very close in merchant marine terms. And all of a sudden, the stern of the American ship went down in the water, and he plunged ahead, and I went right through his rake. And I can imagine, if he's still alive, bless him, the skipper of that American warship saying, if I ever hear a limey again, I'm going to rip his head off. Because there was another thing at the time, you see, on this particular escapade, Dan, is a ship, any ship, including an American ship, if an American merchant marine ship, you call them freighters, we call them cargo ships, if you're sailing through the Mediterranean and a Moroccan warship comes out, you dip your flag. This is the law of the sea. The American ship dips its flag, it salutes the Moroccan warship. The Moroccan or the Tunisian warship dips its flag, it brings its flag up again, and only then does the British or American or the French ship take their flag up again. It's a salute. It's a salute with the flags. And of course, on this particular occasion, I couldn't be on the wheel and on the flag. So not only did I nearly cut an American warship in half, I didn't even salute the poor devil as I sailed past him. But, you know, it's one of my lovely little stories, but there were great men. Great times. What happened?
I don't know. Like I said, I keep searching for answers to that. I think part of it's the brainwashing that we get because they've separated the families. So our young boys typically are being raised by women and yep. The fathers aren't there anymore. So that's part of the problem. I mean, yep. we have rot and decay in all of our societies, all of the institutions that kept us healthy and strong and virile and independent have all been destroyed to weaken us. And I think it was all done intentionally.
Absolutely.
To weaken us to where resistance would not be obtainable. But I got a feeling that the spirit of the men is starting to return, and the spirit of the warrior is starting to return, at least in a portion of our people. I've been to many places in this country, and I've met many warriors who don't go on the internet, who don't appear on any radar screen. They're just getting ready for what they know is coming. They're just making preparations in their hamlets and in their small villages in the mountains, etc. They know what's coming, and they're getting ready for it.
I think they're being very prudent. I don't think anybody are under any illusions, and I do remember saying to my son, as a hospital doctor, and I said to him about 3 years ago, I said, the only thing that I'm not sure about is which is going to collapse first, the European Union or the United States. And, you know, he just burst into laughing, you know, and he said, Dad, he said, you're totally paranoid. You know, he said, this is not going to happen. You know, the United States is a 1,000-year Reich, you know, all the rest of it. But I've been proved right since. And there are many people, you know, I'm small scale, but there are many people in very, very high places who are now saying that America is collapsing. It's not a question of if it will collapse. The economic burdens being borne by the United States, it just can't be upheld. So it's going to collapse. The only thing we don't know is how, when it's going to happen, but we do know that it's going to happen very quickly. And it's really a matter of academia as to whether Europe, the European Union, and by which I mean 28 nations of the European Union or the United States, collapses, because they're so closely integrated. They're both the same family. But when one goes, the other one will go, because they're mutually dependent upon each other. So I suppose the European Union is really largely dependent upon Wall Street. So when Wall Street goes, and it will go, you got 20 trillion debt there. Now, I invite your readers to go onto Google when we finish talking, and just go into Google and write, what is a trillion? They're going to have to sit down. Yeah, this is beyond the human comprehension, the enormity of $1 trillion. And America owes $20 trillion. It's unsustainable. It's like going into your average American family and saying, hi there, I got some news for you. You owe the American government $1 million. And they go and say, well, yeah, this is just not achievable. You know, I only earn whatever I do. And, you know, my rent is only $1,000 a month. How can I pay? Well, you've got to. That's the state that America and Europe finds itself in. It's going to collapse. Europe is going to go the same way as the Soviet Union did in 1989. It's going to be a domino effect. And one country after another is going to come out of the European Union, and they're going to struggle to survive on their own. And the United States will go the same way. But these guys that you're talking about, they're absolutely right. Your system is different over there. You've got a lot of wilderness still in the United States. You've still got a lot of self-sufficiency. This, despite the 7 million who did unfortunately lose their lives during the Great Depression in the 1930s, many in middle America, you know, survived the Great Depression as if it didn't happen, simply because they were self-sufficient. They lived in self-sufficient communities across the Midwest, and they grew their own, and what they ate was very similar to what we did when we were youngsters. 90% of what we ate was either grown or it was killed. What happens today when we're totally dependent about what's on the shelves on the supermarkets?
Yeah, I know, it's precarious.
It's crazy. We just can't survive it.
Hey, Mike, we're down to having about 3 minutes left. If you have any closing comments you want to make.
Only that it was a great pleasure, and I'm in debt to the American people, because I spent so much of my time in my youth there as a seaman, and my father did, of course, as an American citizen. And we have a great debt to America. There is a lot that is good about America, and we want to bring the good bits back to Europe, and wish you all well for the future. And the other thing that is very important to me is that whatever we call ourselves, we are first and foremost ethnic Europeans, and we must stand together or we hang together. And our struggle is your struggle. Your struggle is our struggle. At the end of the day, we're pan-European. Let's keep it that way. Let's keep the family together, hey?
Yeah, I agree with that 1,000%. All right, Michael, again, thank you so much for being on with us. We'll have to do this again at some other time, and I'll certainly keep putting the word out about your books, and just have a blessed day, and again, thanks so much for being with us.
A blessing to you, and a blessing to to America, and of course a very big blessing to the listeners, and I hope to speak with you again, and thank you for the privilege of being allowed to do so today.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening in. Again, that was Mike Walsh, our guest today, and my throat is about ready to quit. So Yahweh bless, and we'll see you next time.